This is program number 4 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. In our previous presentations, we have looked at an argument for the existence of God. We have tried to point out that we're looking at evidence. We are, as Anthony Flew would say, going where the evidence leads. We have talked about atheist challenges to faith in God. We've talked about a logical construction of an argument for the existence of God, mentioning the fact that we aren't dealing with absolute proof, we're dealing with the weight of the evidence. We're talking about where the evidence leads us. In that discussion, we have seen evidence that there was a beginning. We have talked about the fact that the beginning had to be caused, and that cause demands a causer, and that suggestions that somehow something can come from nothing are accomplished by redefining what nothing means, and that in fact all of science would have to be discarded if you were to accept such a proposition. So we had a beginning, and the beginning was caused. In our last presentation, we have talked about intuitive examples of design. By intuitive, we mean something that doesn't necessarily have a purpose, something which cannot be discussed in a mathematical sense, something that is just intuitive. You look at it and you ask yourself, can I really believe that this came into existence by chance? I hope you've listened to the first 3 programs in this series, because you lose continuity if you haven't done that. But it will be obvious as we continue in this discussion what our purpose is. Architectural design. What we're talking about here is questions about the engineering involved in the things that we see in nature. What we're talking about here is the precision that we see, the reason for the shapes that we see in nature. One of the interesting facts about nature is that the most rigid, the strongest, the most economical structure that you can build is a hexagon, a six-sided figure. The wings on a supersonic aircraft are made of hexagons set in a particular order to give maximum strength. We have learned in engineering studies that the hexagon is the strongest structure we can build. And we use that now in a multiplicity of applications. You ever looked at a beehive? Interestingly enough, the beehive is made of hexagons, which are fitted together in a very rigid geometric pattern. If you're going to store something as heavy and as dense as honey in a geometric structure, then the structure you need would be different than it would in open spacing. If you can sort of visualize a triangle, you know, when you make houses, you make the roof out of a triangle. That's open spacing. And I can remember my structural analysis professor in college saying, do you really want to sit on a triangle? But the problem with a triangle is that if you load it up with something dense and heavy, then all of the weight is located on the base of the triangle. And the result is the base will collapse. The hexagon, on the other hand, would have 3 sides that the weight would be distributed across, and that makes it stronger. So the most rigid structure you could build, and the most economical structure you can build to hold something as dense as honey, is the hexagon, the six-sided figure. So bees make their hives out of hexagons. It's pretty difficult to come up with a trial-and-error explanation of this. If you say, well, the first bee that built a hive didn't make it out of a hexagon, and so he found out very quickly he had to make it six-sided because he didn't survive if it wasn't six-sided, you're ignoring the fact that one failure spells the death of the bee. Is it not more reasonable to believe that built into his genetic code was an instruction that said, make your honeycomb six-sided? Architectural design. There are numerous examples of this in the world around us. One of my favorite examples, one of the ones that I think is the most interesting, is the use of what is called the Fibonacci ratio. Fibonacci was a mathematician back in the 13th century who was experimenting with various mathematical progressions. And he came up with what was called a Fibonacci sequence. The sequence is very easy to understand. You just take 2 numbers and add them together, and the next number would be the sum of those 2 numbers. So 1 plus 2 is 3, and 2 plus 3 is 5, and 3 plus 5 is 8, and 5 plus 8 is 13, and 8 plus 13 is 21, and 21 plus 13 is 34. What are we doing? We're adding each number to the previous number to get the next number. So when we say 3 plus 5 is 8, 3, 5, and 8 would be numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. You would not have a 4 or a 6 or a 7 in there because they would not be part of the process. 3, 5, 8, and 13. Well, 3 plus 5 is 8. 5 plus 8 is 13. So 3, 5, 8, and 13 are numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. So I hope that's clear to you. It is a very simple idea. And Fibonacci put it together and he said, isn't that interesting? But what happens is that if you divide each of those numbers, like divide 8 by 13 and divide 13 by 21 and divide 21 by 34, if you do a division, you come up with a constant number. And if you apply it to geometry, then things really get interesting. Because if you build a building in such a way, and let's just take these numbers we're talking about here, if one side is 5 feet long and the other side is 8 feet long, that would be a Fibonacci rectangle. What's interesting about that Fibonacci rectangle is that if you cut a square off of it, a 5 by 5 foot square, what would be left, and you may want to just do this, write it down and look at it, what would be left would be 3 by 5. And 3 by 5 are, in fact, part of the Fibonacci sequence. So cutting squares off of Fibonacci rectangles always gives you another Fibonacci number. So if you took the 3 by 5 and cut a 3 by 3 square off of it, what would be left would be 2. And 2 and 3 are Fibonacci sequence numbers. So there's a very interesting geometric thing that happens with the Fibonacci sequence. And if you're a non-mathematical person, you may be saying, well, what in the world are you doing here? Where are you going with this? Well, what's really interesting about this is that if you connect the corners of those squares, if you've been doing the drawing, and if you draw a line from one corner of the square to the next corner of the square, and then do it again for the next square, what you end up with is a spiral. And that spiral is called a Fibonacci spiral. And what's interesting about the Fibonacci spiral is that the Fibonacci spiral is seen in an incredible number of ways in the world around us. Let me give you some examples. In astronomy, for example, the arms of a spiral galaxy are wound with the Fibonacci spiral. And, you know, we use this kind of thing in decorating buildings and building spiral staircases, but it's present in a galaxy. We see it in the natural world in an infinite number of examples. If you look at the teeth of a grizzly bear or of a groundhog, you'll find that the teeth curve in a Fibonacci spiral. If you look at water going down the drain, it goes down the drain in a Fibonacci spiral. If you look at the curl of the wave, it curls in a Fibonacci spiral. If you look at the proboscis of a moth, it curls in a Fibonacci spiral. If you look at the tubers of potatoes or of pumpkins, they curl in a Fibonacci spiral. If you look at your fingerprint, you'll see that the little lines that make up your fingerprint curl in a Fibonacci spiral. Are you picking up a pattern here? Now the question is, why does this happen? There is no reason for this. You do not have greater strength in a Fibonacci spiral than you do in other structures. We've already talked about hexagons and triangles. There's no strength advantage in the Fibonacci spiral. And give me an explanation that would fit some evolutionary model here. First of all, that wouldn't apply to things in space or water going down the drain. But how are you more fit because your fingerprint curls in a Fibonacci spiral than you would be if it didn't? What's natural selection going to work on? There is absolutely no reason for the Fibonacci spiral to occur in such abundance in nature. And by the way, there's an organization called the Fibonacci Society that does nothing but study examples in nature of Fibonacci spirals. They print books, they print monographs, they have all kinds of studies that have been done. These are people with way too much time on their hands, but the point is that the number of examples is just infinitely large. It's not as though it is an occasional thing, and there's no advantage to it. I want to emphasize that again. I mean, the DNA helix is wound in a Fibonacci spiral. The little structures inside Chlorotella algae are curled in a Fibonacci spiral. There's just an infinite number of examples. Seashells curl in a Fibonacci spiral. There is no reason for this. It offers no strength advantage. It offers no survival advantage. What is the reason for this spiral occurring so frequently in nature, for this example of architectural design? Well, let me give you a little bit different type of possible explanation, which takes us out of science a little bit, but I think is a relevant example of how this might be approached. I live in South Bend, Indiana. I've lived here for a long time. And there's a house on the corner of Ridgedale and York that I always found incredibly beautiful. As a matter of fact, the family that lives there, the Hillmans, were people that I had, I think there were 8 or 9 kids that I had in my physics classes at Riley High School, which is the high school that serves this region of the city. So I was in the house a lot of times. It's an incredible house. The windows on the north side of the house are very small, and they are made of a very special kind of glass. They are well insulated. And it's kind of interesting to look at how they've been built in. It makes the house have sort of an ancient fortress look on the north side. But on the south side, the windows are very, very large and made of a completely different kind of glass. And the roof line of this house is a tiered roof line. It goes in steps, which is typical of this architect. And after you looked at this place for a while and oohed and aahed, which I think most people do because it is such an incredibly beautiful house, I would have said to you, well, this house was built by a very famous architect. His name was Frank Lloyd Wright. I've gotten kind of interested in Frank Lloyd Wright's work over the years because of the Hillman House. I took pictures for the yearbook in that house. I've always enjoyed looking at it as I drive by from day to day. So as I started traveling around the country doing various kinds of programs, I kept running into Frank Lloyd Wright houses. And I always seemed to be able to spot them. I was in Tucson one time, and I was going to the airport in a limo, and we went by a house that had a swimming pool beside it and had a tiered roof and had the same window structures, big windows on the south side, little windows on the other side, and I had the driver's top, and I took some pictures of it. When I got back in, I said, man, that sure looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And he said, well, how'd you know that? That's what it is. I said, well, I recognize the design. A couple of weeks later, I was at Berkeley in California, the University of California, and I went by a building that had the same kind of structure, and I was in a cab at that point. I had the cab driver stop. I got out, took a picture, got back in. I said the same thing. Man, that looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. He said, how'd you know that? Because it is. I said, I recognize the design. And then I had the privilege of visiting probably Frank Lloyd Wright's most famous structure in western Pennsylvania, Falling Waters. This is a house that you ought to stop and see sometime. It's a national monument now. There's a private organization that is keeping it from being destroyed, and it's incredible. He built this house so that it straddles a spring, and that means it heats with it in the winter and it cools with it in the summer without affecting the spring. And each room is specially designed in a way to take advantage of the local situation, what the sun's angle is and how the woods is built around it and so forth. See, I've gotten kind of interested in that kind of architecture. I was in Florida, Lakeland, Florida, the University of Southern Florida, and I was walking on the campus, and I was walking with the dean of students. And I was looking at the buildings, and these buildings were amazing because on the north side, they had a different kind of window than they did on the south side, and the whole campus had this stair-step type of arrangement of roofs, and I said something to the effect of, man, you guys, I said, look at this. Somebody stole Frank Lloyd Wright's ideas and brought them down here to Florida. And he said, well, didn't you see the sign? I said, what sign? And he pointed, and here's this huge sign that says this entire university was designed by the famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright. You see, there is an intelligence that has used a design that is particularly aesthetically appealing to us. Man is different than all of the living things. We aren't just about survival of the fittest. There are things that each one of us engage in that do not offer us any survival advantage. As a matter of fact, it may even cost us something because we appreciate beauty. And every one of us has the capacity for this. Some of you can look at a piece of art and say Picasso or Van Gogh. Some of you, most of you, can listen to a piece of music and say Beethoven or Garth Brooks or Louis Armstrong or whatever. And how do you know that? Well, you appreciate that creativity. Some of you are interested in needlepoint. Some of you are interested in artwork involving the use of beads. Some of you are interested in gardening. Some of you are interested in horticulture, in animal husbandry. Some of you are interested in checkers or athletics or fishing. Not for survival. We are human beings. We are created in the image of God. We'll talk later about what that means. One of the fundamental things it does is it provides us with the opportunity to see beauty in nature, an appreciation of aesthetics. And sometimes we will spend large amounts of money to have something that is of incredible beauty. I have seen pictures sell for millions of dollars because people appreciate beauty and aesthetics. Some of us are engaged in things that are because of our appreciation of beauty that will never bring us financial advantage. We don't use them, we don't engage in them because they offer us any money advantage of any kind, but simply that we appreciate those aesthetics. We love beauty. And so Fibonacci and other examples in nature are not there for survival. They're not there for strength. They're there because God has an appreciation of beauty. And many things have been created that have incredible beauty. Sometimes we see colors in caves where nobody can see them, or deep in the ocean, that we may discover don't have any survival advantage at all, but have been created to show beauty, to show aesthetic value. Architectural design. There are two types. The types that give us strength, that give us the advantage of power and structure, like the hexagons and other things that we see in nature. And then those things that are just there for the aesthetic value that they offer us. As we have looked at these examples, we have seen things that are descriptive in nature. And I realize that for many people, being descriptive is not particularly convincing. Many times we see people, particularly in the scientific community, who are interested in providing an alternative to believing that there is intelligence and purpose behind the things we see. I'm sure someone has constructed a model to explain how the first hexagon came into existence. And I could come up with an imaginative proposal. Being able to propose something doesn't mean that's what happened, and especially when there is massive complexity involved. Sometimes we seem to have people who think that if they can provide any possible explanation, that necessarily has to be the answer. The weight of the evidence is how many examples we see in nature, how many times we see architectural structures that have a design that we look at and say, isn't that gorgeous? Isn't that beautiful? The beauty in the creation around us. Consider the lilies of the field. You know, you can attract insects without having to have beautiful color. Consider the beauty seen in a child. The structures that make up our human bodies, some of which are there because they give us maximum survival potential, but some of them are there simply because they reflect the wisdom and design built into us. May I suggest to you who are listening to this and who are saying, well, you know, that's fine, but it's just your opinion about it, that the next step in this discussion has to be, okay, what is possible statistically? This is called irreducible complexity, intelligent design. And I want to emphasize, as we get ready to discuss this in the next presentation, that intelligent design is not a methodology of science. One of the major misunderstandings among both atheists and creationists has been that somehow intelligent design is viewed as being a scientific methodology. We will not cure cancer through intelligent design. It is not a way of doing research. It is an apologetic. What I mean by that is, it is an evidence for the existence of God. What I'm referring to is the fact that we can ask, where does the evidence lead us? And that's what intelligent design does. It leads us to some conclusions about our own existence, our own nature, and about the nature of God. But it is not a method of doing science. And one of the unfortunate things that has happened is, even ending up with a court case in Delaware, that people were thinking that somehow this is used as an alternative to scientific proposals. That's not the case at all. The question is, can we believe in blind naturalism? In other words, that everything that we see, everything that we experience, everything that we are, that everything that is a part of our existence can be explained in terms of natural process. Or is it statistically irresponsible to suggest that chance is a mechanism that can do all those things? What is the evidence? Where does the evidence lead us statistically, mathematically, about whether or not chance is a valid mechanism to explain all that we see around us? We've talked about intuitive design. We've talked about architectural design. Our next discussion is about mathematical design. And we hope that you'll continue on in your investigation of design as a property of whatever caused the beginning.